This is a production of Cornell University.
No.
CJC meeting, what is today? March 5th, 2013.
Well, hi everybody. Much larger turnout than normally I'd expected, but some good topics for discussion.
It's the pizza.
It's the pizza. I'll just really quick go around and do some quick introductions just so you have an idea of who's with us today. My name is Greg Mezzi. I'm an employee here at the university. I'm the chair of the CJC, so I'll start there with Randy.
Randy Wayne, member of the UA University Assembly.
Ari Epstein, assistant director of the Assembly's office.
Lee Cummings, I'm the victim advocate at Connect, and Ari invited me.
Kathy
Zoner,
the chief at Cornell.
Jim Blair, representing the University Assembly.
Rachel Wild, faculty member of the CJC.
Alex Moore, graduate
student. Eric Chafis, faculty. I'm a member of the faculty senate. I was trained to observe.
I'm Risa Lieberwitz. I'm in the ILR school. I'm a faculty, and I'm interested in some of the issues you guys are discussing, and was a former member of this committee.
I'm Jessica Hittleman. I'm a law student. I'm also a judicial code counselor.
I'm Andrew Watts. I'm also JCC.
Hi, I'm Mary Beth Grant, and I work as the judicial administrator.
Peter Shelfo, student, member of the University Assembly and CJC.
Great. I'm going to try to make sure we provide adequate time for both items on the agenda, both old and new business, since we do have a good audience for our new business items. So I wanted to... I sent out yesterday and apologized for the short notice of sending all of my attachments, but I figured I would rather get it to you, and these are probably documents and things that over the next few weeks and few meetings we'll probably be referring to more. So I wanted to get it in your hands, and it was not my expectation that everybody go through it and read it all, because there was quite a bit, and I struggled to get through all of it with all the other things going on in life. First item on the agenda is approval of the past two meeting minutes, which were sent out yesterday. So does anybody have any additions or subtractions, or would anybody like more time to review the minutes before we approve them? Is there any, Ari, what's the formal rule?
Seeing no objection.
Seeing no objection. I guess the meeting minutes are approved for the last two meetings. For old business, we have the resolution that Mary Beth sort of drafted some language to in regard to the campus code to clarify the rights of complainants to the appeal summary decision agreement. A lot of words in that title. And both the JCC and the JA's office sent out a sort of a brief response to that and to the points in there. So I guess I can probably give sort of maybe both of you 5 minutes to just sort of run through each one of your points as it relates to the resolution, and then we'll sort of open it up for questions, discussion, and then see where that sort of leads us.
Sure.
All right, so I guess I'll start with the JA's, Mary Beth.
So I put together this proposal about the rights of a complainant to appeal decisions of the JA to either dismiss the case or if the JA has entered into an agreement with an accused person. Jessica had mentioned last week that there was a particular case that dealt with this last fall. The hearing board interpreted it in a way that wasn't the way that I interpreted, obviously raised good points, but I thought that it was important for this body to also consider it, see if they agree, which perspective they want to go, because either way, I think the code needs to be clarified. And then also it came up in an audit of our office, because we've always interpreted that this section applies only to individual complainants and not institutional complainants, and the audit office pointed out that that should be clarified, because if it's intended to be institutional complainants, we're doing it wrong. So as I was reflecting on how to summarize the reasons that I thought we should make these changes, the question to me for three out of the four of the changes that I put in here
the question that really hits on them is, what is the purpose? In the context of our whole code, what is the purpose of this right to appeal? And I believe that it's in there, as a check on the power of the judicial administrator. If you think about it in the context of the judicial administrator operating in an independent way from the administration, receives a complaint, investigates the complaint, and then either dismisses it or enters into an agreement with an accused person, the complainant may not be satisfied with that result. So the code provides this opportunity for somebody else, in the form of the hearing board, to take a look at that and say, is that okay? The concern is that there could be mistakes on the Office of the Judicial Administrator, that we don't get the notice out in a timely fashion for all kinds of reasons. In the particular case last year, last semester, there was a pregnancy, a baby. We were late. I take responsibility for it, but we were 3 weeks late getting the notice out to the complainant. And the hearing board said, because of that delay, no fault of the complainant, but the complainant lost his right to appeal. Doesn't feel fair. Seems like of all times that there could be an excuse for a mistake, you know, that particular situation would have warranted providing the opportunity to give more time for the extension. And I appreciate the JCC, I'm not going to speak for them, but they said, well, I'll just give more time. But in any situation, no matter how much time there is, there could always be that kind of mistake. There could also be, what we used to call the Skippy JA, who intentionally, like, I'm sick of this damn complainant, leave me alone, and, you know, intentionally doesn't give that the person the proper timely notice. Hopefully that wouldn't happen. I mean, that we don't want to make that assumption, but I do think that we need to think about worst case scenarios. So the sense of the way that I drafted the changes is to make it clear that this right belongs to the complainant and to protect the complainant from mistakes that the JA's office might make, to have not a time limit that's going to explode and completely cut the complainant off of these rights, but to still, you know, allow for human error that could happen. With respect to the individual complainant versus the institutional complainant, I know the JCC's office doesn't oppose this, but I feel like the audit's office position should be presented as well. In the audit, they didn't say that they had an opinion one way or another, but, you know, their office is one that could be impacted by not having an institutional complainant right to appeal. You know, for example, just before the winter break, we dismissed 4 or 5 complaints that the audit office had put forward. We didn't think there was sufficient evidence. So the audit office could really disagree with us. And I'm using them as an example. It could be the Cornell Police. It could be the libraries. It could be any institutional complainant. They could really disagree with that kind of decision. And right now, there would be no opportunity through the code for them to appeal. I personally think that that's okay. I think that the reason we have the appeal right for an individual complainant is because they're the ones that have less power, you know, within the context of the whole code compared to the university. And, you know, if, you know, say KZ is noticing a pattern of the JA's office not bringing forward cases that they think there's sufficient evidence for, there are other avenues that an institutional complainant could use to have a conversation with the JA, go over the JA's head, and not have the person
bring the audit office back in.
So I think that this protection is really designed to protect an individual complainant. And I actually think it undermines the independence of the office if an institutional complainant had that right. You know, if all of a sudden, say, pick on you, Casey, since you're here, if all of a sudden the police were not satisfied and didn't think that the JA was going strongly enough against complainants and started challenging the sometimes 1,000 summary decision agreements that we enter into a year, that would have a huge impact on the work.
And we have no interest.
Right. But anyway, so I think that part is clear. I think that sort of summarizes the two main issues.
Okay. From the JCC's perspective?
Sure. I'll just kind of start by at least simplifying in my mind how I simplify this issue, and I think that might help, you know, to instead of looking at my lengthy memo. So there's kind of two issues that we do dispute with the DA's office. One is whose right this right is. However, we're not disputing that this is a check on the DA's office, that the complainant should have a right to appeal. That's not at all what's being contested, and I don't want to be unclear about that. What we're contesting is, in terms of whose right it is, there's also protections for the accused student in here, and they're not here on their face. There's no real language about the accused student. However, what's important to understand is that in providing some time limitation, and again, as I noted in my memo, and as Mary Beth has noted, we're willing to expand the time that the DA's office has in order to provide notification to a complainant, but in having some kind of timing restriction, that means that at some point I can tell my clients, clients can know from reading the code that their summary decision agreement that they've agreed to is final. They can go ahead and start working on the terms of their summary decision agreement, usually like community service, could be counseling, could be an independent study, could be a paper, whatever it is, they can start working on that and they can continue to plan their academic future based on that summary decision agreement. They know what's going to be on their record, what's not going to be on their record. There's a lot of information contained in the SDA that will affect the student's lives going forward, and it's not something that can wait a matter of months. And so, again, our real concern is not the amount of time that that is. I wouldn't want it to be longer than a week, I would say, just in the interest of fairness, but it doesn't have to be 2 days. It doesn't have to be 3 days. It can be 5 days to account for, you know, like general issues that come up at the DA's office. However, for an issue like this one, where it was a 3 week period, something that doesn't come up a lot with the maternity leave, obviously everyone in the DA's office is very, well, I don't know if that doesn't come up a lot, but it's obviously, like the DA's office, as you know Mary Beth, she's very diligent, everyone there is very diligent, it's not going to be an issue that's coming up a lot. But for that issue to have happened, is it unfair to complain that lost their complainant's rights? Of course, like they should have had the right to appeal like everybody else. It's very unfortunate. But to change the code now so that no accused students can know when their SDAs are final, to me, is not at all the solution. I'll just echo what Mary Beth said, which is that individual complainants, we are obviously in that same position, that they're the ones who should have accused rights. That's not being disputed. And in terms of the Skippy JA point that Mary Beth came up talking about, I don't believe that we should be writing the code necessarily to account for a Skippy JA. I think that, you know, we in our office try to select people who are ethical. I know that Mary Beth is the same. And I don't think it's really the CJC's responsibility to put a check on the JA's office in that way. And I also would say that I could see a situation where a Skippy JA would not like the accused student delay the notice to the complainant so that they've already completed a lot of their SDA when it gets disputed and they have to go back and redo it. So I don't think that really the Skippy JA argument holds a lot of merit here. But I know it's a complicated issue for those of you who don't deal with this every day, and I just want to simplify to say that our real concern here is that there are protections for the accused student, which is that they get to know at a certain point, my summary decision can be final, I can move forward with my life, and it's very important for the students that I work with. And Andrew, do you have anything to add?
No, I mean, I think I would echo it. You know, we're not contesting the complainant has this right or this shield, but, you know, the right comes at an expense, and that expense is, you know, the defendant or the accused student's, you know, ability to put something behind them and move on. And, you know, due to clerical error, administrative, you know, there's only, what, 4 or 5 of you in there, and Lord knows how many cases you have. You know, it's going to happen. We're okay with that and give them a little bit more flexibility with their administrative burden, but, you know, to go to all the way to the one extreme where it says, you know, at any point in time in your next 3 years of your life here at Cornell, if you want to appeal this decision, you know, feel free, and all of a sudden we have people coming back in 3 years later who thought they were graduating. So we're reopening this coast case even though we both signed it, you know, 3 years ago. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of our only real concern coming out of this.
Peter, can I ask a quick question? So I know that the code has a statute of limitation for 1 year, so could they bring something back that's a year old? Or is that would be the cap for this?
I don't know if you want to answer. There's kind of two different situations. One is that the JA's office has the right to bring charges against the student, and that's kind of what that 1 year statute of limitations has to do with. And this is kind of a different issue, which is that the JA's already brought charges against the accused student, the JA and the accused student have come to some sort of agreement. It's called a summary decision agreement, which is basically like a plea bargain in the criminal system. And now the complainant also has a right to appeal. And generally, under the code, the way it stands now, that's a pretty quick process because within a couple of days, the JA notifies the complainant, here's the decision that we came to, and the complainant has a few days to think it over and say, nope, that's not, I don't feel that my rights were protected and I want to go before a board and have this disputed. So it's kind of two different issues.
Randy has a question.
I, after reading both of your memos and hearing what you said, I'd like to propose two changes that take into consideration those things that you wrote and said. Change the two business days to 5 days. With that, eliminate the sentence that starts on 18 and 19 that says the accused student is encouraged to confirm for the judicial.
Hold on one second, sorry. I don't have a packet copy. I have an old copy with old numbers.
Oh.
So can we share?
Yeah. Because that's not the student's job. It's just not the student's job. And I can tell you, when you go to ask the administration a question, it could take a lifetime to get an answer. So it's not the student's job. Please put that in the minutes. And lastly, the right to petition belongs exclusively to the individual complainant and not in the section intended to create a right for the accused. That seems superfluous that it says nothing about the accused. So I don't understand that sentence. And I would rather have it not there unless somebody can explain to me.
Can you repeat that last one so I can...
The right to a petition belongs exclusively to the individual complainant and nothing in the sections intended to create a right to the accused.
27, 28.
The reason I included it was because of the considering the accused person's right to rely on this paragraph as a way to say that the FDA was final. That's what was intended by that. I might not have articulated it as well as it could have been.
I still vote for removing it. Are there other?
And I like the rest.
Questions about this? I guess my question that I would have is, are we both in agreement, both groups, in agreement on the trigger for the timing?
If it's limited to a period of 2 or, as amended, 5 days, I think that we're okay with the triggering event being that, just so that then they can still calculate how many days. Obviously, the sooner the better for us, but in the interest
sure.
of agreeing,
yeah.
I agree.
Well, and so let me ask Mary Beth, so the issue is that rarely, but sometimes, you don't get it out in the 2 days.
Right.
So rather than extending and then making it longer for everything, is there, I hate to add process to process, however, you're working in a union environment in the grievance process, if we can't, or either side can't complete what they're supposed to complete in a timely manner, then you have a process by which you ask for an extension. You're either granted the extension or not granted the extension. So it may be duplicative because if you could do that, then you
yeah,
could
yeah.
So
yeah,
I just want to throw it on the table.
Yeah. The issue is mistake because
right.
the summary decision agreement is signed. It
right.
becomes final 2 days later, and then within the next 2 days, you have to get the notice out. So we're on to the next case. And
right.
most of the time, it's not an issue. You know,
right.
you have a tickler in your system, you do something, but sometimes there'll be something.
Is
and
the 5 days even helpful then? I mean,
well,
or does that just extend the time where you're going to miss it?
Yeah. I mean,
and
it
why
could help
it
because
that
those 2 days could land in an awkward, you know, timing in terms of vacation or something. So definitely I would say we should at least expand it to 5 business
okay.
days. But, you know, the other way to approach it, it would be to say if there's a mistake to allow the complainant the ability to petition then. I mean, that would be rather than asking,
mm-hmm.
having the JA anticipate the mistakes. That's just not the
yeah,
scenario
yeah.
that would happen.
Right.
But to say, you know, like using the case, it's been 3 weeks. The complainant contacts us. That's how I got notified that we had made the mistake. And it's the royal we. In that situation, if we had something to say, at that point, do a balance of the equities. Because it might be different, and I don't even know if you're thinking about when I'm thinking back to what the chair wrote in that case, part of her rationale was,
Well, it might not have been the sanction that the complainant wanted, but there was some sanction. Might she have felt differently if it was a dismissal and there was nothing? And I think what triggers something for me that I can't quite identify, maybe it's just guilt because I made a mistake, but it's like the absolute cutting off of any possibility of a thing. And if there is a balance of equities, maybe there's something that would be out there that really would say this really is unfair to a complainant in a way that's different from another situation, or maybe it doesn't create an unfairness to the accused because, you know, for whatever reason, he or she wouldn't have already started on the sanctions or wouldn't have relied on it. I don't know, but maybe that would be a compromised position. But I definitely would appreciate the extra extra couple of days.
I mean, a lot comes to your office. So.
Yeah. It feels like it doesn't leave room for human error.
Right.
And, you know, as many conversations as we have with students all the time, everyone makes mistakes. Like, I do make mistakes.
Rachel, did you have something?
No.
Okay. Jim? Is there anybody else that would like to provide comments?
Yeah, if I could just chime in, because I've had all of like an hour to try to get up on this and try to grapple with this. But I would be concerned that a complainant would lose the rights, and I think what you just said, I would like to see some safeguard in there in the event that, you know, you get hit by a bus walking in and you're... But I'm just saying, in the event, I hate to take away the possibility of some kind of going to a hearing board chair or something that could resolve that, because I certainly appreciate the JCC's perspective on the accused, and I respect that absolutely, the stress put on accused students. I've worked with accused students as a victim advocate. I've also worked with complainants, and the complainants additionally or similarly are under stress and are awaiting the resolution and are living with whatever may have happened to them. So I think in many ways that's comparable, and they too want to get on and know that it's been resolved. So I think their feelings are very similar, but that's why I wouldn't want to lose some safeguards in there that they could petition to somebody that there was an error.
So in the case of late or no notice, then there might
I just don't know how to put a timeline on it.
Still sticks with, you know, you get the person's already worked this far into a summary decision agreement, that has to count for something. And,
like time served
yeah.
in the legal system,
yeah, maybe,
you know,
yeah.
something like that, or I don't know, but something.
With
balance. Go ahead.
I just want to respond to that. So in terms of the, I kind of want to address two things separately. So one, Chief Donner's point about the opportunity to appeal to like a different body or something, or have some balancing of the equities, I appreciate that, and I think that it makes a lot of sense. However, my concern would be the same as it is in the original case, which is I can't ever promise anything. And another thing that I just want to address separately is I agree with Mary Beth that it's scary that because the J makes a human error, a complainant loses their rights, it's not fair compared to another complainant. But I think there's a couple of considerations to have. One, this only happened, as far as I know, this one time.
Well, honestly, it's not the first time the mistake has happened. It's the only time that the complainant had wanted to appeal.
Okay. I mean, I just think it's a rare, even if
it's
the first
rare.
Time, it's a rare situation. Like, the J is good at their job. They have reminders. If the J that was on the case hadn't been out on maternity leave and had a baby, this wouldn't have happened. And I think, so A, it's such a rare instance this would happen, and B, it's not going to be uncommon where, like in this case, there was already sanctions, and I think we also have to remember that it's not like the case just goes away because the complainant has lost their right to appeal it. Like, the JA also has the good sense to come to summary decision agreements with the complainant in mind, and I'm not saying, again, I'm not advocating that you take away the complainant's appeal right. I think it's great, but I think it's important to remember that even in those situations where this might happen, there's already been a level of adjudication in these cases. So it's not like nothing now is happening. I guess that would be my response.
Tim, or does anyone have any?
So I'm a little confused. I understand what Brandy has recommended, but what change would you or would you not make to this? As Mary Beth Brandis drafted it.
I think our problem is, you know, the thing we've addressed, you know, again, we understand there's clerical error, and if we need to, you know, expand the window, that's fine by us, but our interest is in finality, and
you know, the language in here that says as soon as practical thereafter, you know, things that just kind of extend, you know, puts an open-ended window on how long our clients have to just sit there and
so say, you would strike, or as soon as practical thereafter?
As long as the things that were suggested earlier, that last sentence, 27, 28, and the 18 and 19 in the paragraph before. But, you know, anything, a delay on the part of the JA shall not negatively impact the complainant's right to appeal. That all that language was kind of open, you know, puts an open-ended spectrum on, you know, when these things can be challenged is what we're concerned with. And, you know, these clerical absences, I've never had one happen in my tenure prior to that, but, you know, if they happen, you know, someone's going to lose a right, you know, the burden's going to fall on somebody. It's nobody's, you know, it's a JA's clerical error, whatever, it's going to fall on either the complainant, you know, or the accused. And the status quo right now is, you know, that falls on the complainant and it's 2 days and maybe that is a little too harsh. So that's something that, you know, you guys should consider. But, I mean, this is going to be a complete reversal and you're going to put that burden now on the defendant who's already, you know, gone through the, you know, the trenches here and had his...
We're not talking about a case dismissal per se, other
right.
than that could have
right.
been what the summary decision agreement
right.
was.
Right.
That generally speaking, that what the issues are brought forward. So this is a triggering... How long does the complainant then have to
3 days?
3 days. So that in total, you're expanding it from five to eight.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And actually, the irony is that when the complainant would appeal, we would be opposing the complainant in the hearing. You know. So
I guess my question, just for clarification, mm-hmm. is it the JCC's desire to essentially strike 17 through 19 then?
Yes.
The proposed language.
Yes.
Yeah, I mean, the 18 and 19 was, you know, recommended down there. Our, you know, our 17 is primarily what we'd be concerned with, the
mm-hmm.
practical thereafter and delay on the part of the JA. That's the two provisions that were our primary you know, contention is with.
And so, just so we can get this thing and keep
mm-hmm.
moving. So in line 14, both parties are in agreement for that. Two to go to five.
Right.
And
I would not. I would unstrike no more than, and I would. Yeah, but the 2 to 5 is fine.
Okay. Just so
yeah, no more than five business.
Yeah.
No more than five business days.
They're allowed to do it earlier.
Yeah.
we all.
Chance of forgetting. Right?
We all agree that the addition of an individual is
yeah.
essential.
Yeah.
That's fine.
Okay.
Or.
Yeah, I mean, I don't
like
it.
Yeah, I mean, I'm trying to go through. So anybody who has, as we go through this.
I don't know if this is possible. I mean, I'm convinced that this is an unwieldy tool that really puts too much of a burden on an accused. Because I agree that what people need is finality. I don't know how you would write this in, but would there be a way to write in that the complainant has 5 business days and could have more, but only if the JA attests that there was error on the JA's part? And then you wouldn't have absolute certainty, but you could say to your client, you have absolute certainty, except in a rare event that the JA messed up, in which case the JA will be issuing a lot of mea culpa. Is that legally right of
her? It doesn't really remedy the case that they're trying to fix, but that's the issue.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So I mean, the burden has
yeah.
to fall on somebody, and you know we just don't want the status quo is, we think, a little bit rough, and then it's 2 days
yeah.
and falling on the complainant. You know, maybe we extend that, but for us it's just, you know, a wholesale switch to put that burden now on the accused student, the defendant.
No, well, I'm not.
Or
saying,
but even doing it,
yeah.
even doing that in that one case, you know what I mean, in that one case where the, you know, the error is not the complainant or the accused students, it's, you know, that's what we're concerned about.
I wish that there was some way
yeah.
to hold the JA accountable for the mistake
yeah.
instead
yeah.
of burdening
yeah.
either party.
Yeah.
And that's what
yeah.
I really wish.
Yeah.
But I couldn't think of a way to
right.
do that.
Yeah. Our it's just our real concern here is finality
right.
and finality. I mean, there's no extension of a final.
Jim?
My question is, what makes a summary decision final? What? So that's the trigger.
Mm-hmm.
is that, you know, everybody's come to it and you finally get to it in your desk and you go, that seems reasonable, and you sign off? Is that the...
When we enter into a summary decision that includes an admission of violation and sanctions, the accused student has 2 days for like a cooling period. Some states have that when you buy a car, you get 2 days cooling period. So that the signature plus 2 days makes it final. For a case that's being dismissed, it's a little more vague because it would probably be that the JA writes to the accused student saying, I'm dismissing your case.
Well, my point is would both parties reasonably know when this thing is signed?
Final
issue.
And that's why I put this in here, and I appreciate what you're saying. Students are really busy, too. But that's why I put in here about the accused student contacting the JA's office to see, to get that notice out, because they would know when it's signed. The complainant would not know when it's signed.
Ari?
Is there any reason that a complainant, the definition of a final summary decision agreement couldn't be revised to say it's not final until the complainant has received notice? Mm-hmm. Or that the complainant needs to...
Isn't the agreement, though, between the accused and the...
To the university.
Yeah.
Not between the accused and the complainant.
That's
so
right.
the decision and the agreement, it's not with the... I'm getting all confused. It's not with the complainant. It's
That's
with
true.
The confused.
I mean, complainant.
It could be. Sorry. I'm trying.
I guess the question I'm asking is how come part of that finality requirement couldn't be that the JA has to staple an email to the agreement that shows that it has been transmitted to.
But so I think the challenge is, you know, probably this is similar except reverse. If we were to write to the complainant prior to the agreement being signed, the agreement may not be signed or it could be revoked in 2 days. So then we have a complainant who thinks it's final, and so and that's why we don't sign the agreement as the student is walking out the door, so we don't write to the complainant right then, because
two days later.
Yeah, it's like a buyer's remorse kind of
thing.
It just seems like there should be some way to have a workflow where the final step is notification to both parties that this is final.
Notification to both parties.
Yeah. And then the triggers, I don't know.
And then there would be no reliance on it until that final notice goes out.
Well, then my concern is, I mean, if, maybe I'm a little confused by what's being discussed, but if, so basically there's not a limitation on when notice has to be received by or when the complainant has to appeal by, but there is notice of a final. So it could just be the complaint. So it would just be an accused student waiting for an email from the J, and it could be months. I mean, I don't find that to be better. Unless I'm misunderstood, I could be misunderstood.
No, I need pictures. All right. So if instead of the accused and the J meet, they read the summary.
Mm-hmm.
So as part of her notification to the complainant, she also re-notifies the accused of what is known to be, but that notice is just to the accused that the complaint has been served, essentially speaking?
That's what you're suggesting.
And then there's a two-day, then the accused knows that when they receive that, there's 2 days that person has to contemplate that decision. I mean, they're not going to get any new information. They've already signed off on what the information is, so it's not like there's a negotiation going back and forth. They just get re-notified of something that they've already signed, but also notified that the complainant's been notified.
So what that
adds is if that accused is sitting there after signing the summary decision agreement, and now it's been a week, and nobody's heard anything, they can say, I need to get this over with. And they can say, what the heck's going on? This was supposed to be served back to me within 2 days or 5 days, whatever we land on. And I need to get moving on my summary decision agreement, and I haven't heard anything. So they come back to you, or they can go directly to the JA's office. And there's another fail-safe to catch the clarifier, and allow them to be a party to finalizing that. as opposed to waiting and kind of throwing things up in the ether.
I mean, I guess I have two just kind of, I guess, comments to that. Is that one, I don't know administratively how they want to work, however that notice process or that, that I don't know that that's part of, the sort of responsibility, how they want to handle their administrative, notice serving up, on their listserv, just an automatic email that goes out whenever you enter into the system or whatever. I think that's kind of for them, not necessarily for the code. But secondly, again, it's not an agreement between the accused student and the complainant. The, if they get this notice and they say, I don't think that's right, they appeal her decision, and it usually ends up being the JCC and the JA against the complainant. That's kind of the normal, effect of that. So it's not like, I don't think the complainant should have a right to, whether this SDA is final. That's an agreement between the defendant, the accused student, and the, and the university saying, I accept responsibility, whatever, this is the sanctions I'm agreeing to. And if...
No, I didn't mean to say that. If that's okay. What I said, that's...
Well, no, I'm just saying if you're going to infuse the complainant into when this thing can become final,
I was just trying to double notify. I was just only trying to...
Just make an automatic...
What you're accusing is the notification.
Right, the notification to the complainant, that's all.
Okay, yeah, that was my first point about the administrative stuff. However they want to operate their office in that term, I think...
Well, that, it is already... The notification is already written into the code.
Right.
The only thing I would do is adding some language that's not just a notifying the complainant. It might read...
What line are you referring to?
I don't have the numbers. The first line of the...
Right here.
Following the number four.
Okay.
The judicial administrator shall notify the complainant and the accused no more than 5 business days after summary decision becomes final, because that's the same terminology.
Mm-hmm.
And the accused just understands that they now know that the notice has gone out, and in 2 days they can start their summary decision agreement without however 5 days.
Unless they're notified that it's been retracted.
Unless what?
No, appeal.
I just have a question. So would that be, and then you would leave in the language about as soon as, is that?
No, that's just
all
agree.
All you're talking about is just extra notice?
Extra notice to the accused.
Right.
So the accused actually knows when the complainant gets served, so that actually gives them a chronological timeline on when they're end, whether, and then the extension of changing the word of 2 to 5.
But does that give any extra time to the JA if there's any error?
If we change to 5. 2 to 5.
Yeah.
But nothing after.
What I'm hearing Ari say is something that takes it a step further to say that it's not until that notice goes out that it becomes final. So you go to the section on summary decision.
I guess I'm basically saying wherever the notice is provided to the accused, whether it's when they sign or whatever,
mm-hmm.
part of that step where that agreement and the clock starts ticking for this 2 business days requirement is fire off an email to the complainant or whatever saying.
So is there a reason, I think, is the question of, so I signed a summary decision agreement with you.
Right.
Why can't you just notify the complainant then, right then?
Because the agreement isn't final for 2 days.
Because even after they sign it, there's
2 days.
Right.
So my question is, at that 2-day period, after that 2-day, when it becomes final, can notice go out to the complainant and the accused that the 5-day ticker starts?
Right. That is what happens currently. It's what happens in the 1 in 100 case where, for maternity leave reasons, that notice doesn't
5 years
decide.
Ago, that was.
that's, I hate to say it, I mean, and I completely respect the JA's office, but that's a performance issue in the JA's office.
Yeah.
And whoever basically is your supervisor, that's a performance issue. You know what I mean?
Right, and that's why I said earlier.
I think absent the fact that it affects people, then we would be having that conversation.
Yes.
I think we're trying to figure out is how do we make it equitable to both parties.
I guess my question is... In this situation,
I know they happen, but why write something that allows for mistakes?
I agree with that.
I guess this is my question.
Every line could have that same...
Well, most mistakes that people make can be corrected in one day. In one way or another. So, for example, we have notice requirements for having a hearing, 7 calendar days, 7 business days for notice of a hearing. If we mess up on that, reschedule the hearing if there hasn't been enough time. If you don't get your witness list in on time, you might lose the chance to have your witness. Or you can ask for a continuance, or you can explain that there were extenuating circumstances. You just learned about the witness. So most mistakes, the code is full of these landmines that we're always trying to negotiate to try to, you know, we work really hard, as Jeff said, to make sure we're honoring all of them. And with very few exceptions, most mistakes are fixable. This is one of the few situations, the statute of limitations being the other, that if you miss this deadline, that it's like you complete jump off cliff.
But you're also, you also mentioned, though, in 32, that the trigger for the event of the timing is the receipt of the notice, right?
Right. Well, that's just to differentiate for the, you know, if there was a delay, you know, like in the case we talked about earlier where there's a 3-week delay, right. That saying that the receipt of the notice 3 weeks later would still trigger it.
Which is why we're saying we're only okay with the triggering language if there's some limitation as to when they have to get notice.
Right.
That's if there's a 2 to 5 day limitation as to when they have to get notice, then the triggering event being the notice is okay, because then I can say, listen, you signed your SCA today. Within 5 days, the complainant's going to be contacted, and then within 3 business days of that, if you haven't heard anything, you know that your SCA is signed off. Does that make sense?
It makes sense completely. It's just I think we're all trying to figure out how we can work in these 1 in 5,000 cases, which doesn't seem feasible because we've discussed so many options and nobody can understand one of them.
What we're saying on that issue as an office, and maybe this will help like summarize, is that I guess it would be, you know, the clerical errors that are made in the JA's office. No one's saying they're not unfortunate to complainants, but they happen so rarely. Equities have already been taken into consideration in the SCAs, and to now change all of the process for all of the accused students because of these errors is putting a huge burden on the accused students that I don't think is due in the interest of fairness. Like, I think you're putting a huge burden on accused students when something is wrong so rarely, and I'm not going to speculate as to what the wrong is being done in every single case, because it could be a dismissal of a very serious case, and the complainant could feel really shafted by that. I'm not going to say it's not, but there are considerations already in place, and to make these changes is going to affect every accused. This is every accused student comes to the JA's office.
But not if they occur so rarely. I mean, it's the same argument. It won't affect them.
The potential waiting period is much broader.
Yeah.
What I'm telling students every time would be, I don't know. Under this language map drafted by the JA, I would just be able to say every time we have a subdivision agreement, I'd be like, well, you can start your SCA, but I don't know, truthfully, when they're going to get noticed, and I don't know when you'll find out what's final.
I'm going to go to Jim, then Ari.
So I realize that we're trying to perfect this, and I think we got for the sake of this meeting, I would recommend that we reinsert no more than change 2 to 5, strike from line 17 for after file changes to the end of the paragraph. I think what I'm hearing is that's an acceptable compromise between the JA and the JCC. It does not perfect the possible mistake issue, but both seem to think that would take care of and improve the situation. If that is not what this body wants to do, then I recommend this be tabled and we think offline and come back with more thought out stuff at the next meeting.
Jim?
I don't mean to complicate things, but we would also want 27 through 28 as previously noted stricken.
Yes, I'm not trying to.
Okay.
I'm trying to deal with this one particular point.
Sure.
Can I just take a straw poll? Is that within my right?
Sure.
Okay. I'm gonna sort of survey the crowd. Is everybody relatively in agreement with the changes that Jim had mentioned just in that first paragraph that would essentially go from lines 15 to 20?
Put it back the way it was, except changing it to 5.
Right.
And did we add and the accused?
No.
No. Okay.
So I guess noting with that, my concern about that is it doesn't really address the case that was the trigger for this issue. I'm sorry, I just want to get back to it because I'm trying to visualize how this process works.
Yes.
So a student comes in to sign the summary decision agreement. Mm-hmm. Is there like a form with like did you do this, did you do that, that's associated with a summary decision agreement?
Yeah, so it's first it quotes the code, then there's a statement of admission, then it lists all the sanctions.
So is there like a checklist somewhere too?
A process form, so met with student, check.
Within our office, we have logistical ways that we try to...
I'm just wondering if there is a way that, and perhaps it wouldn't be the rules that are in this resolution right now, maybe it is part of that summary decision agreement process, that one of the things on that checklist is summary decision agreement as signed, sent to complainant. If you give them 5 business days, then they have 3 business days after it becomes final, assuming that there isn't...
it's still not going to take care of the issue. This case got lost, as I understand it, because it was in someone who wasn't present to be purview. And that person wasn't present, and the case didn't get transferred to somebody else's eyes so that it could be followed.
That person had a summary decision meeting where they signed the checklist, and they just didn't follow up 2 days later to send the notice off. What if that notice happened at the time that the summary decision agreement was signed?
It can't because the accused didn't have 2 days to take it back.
But what harm does it do if the complainant receives it? I mean, the worst thing is the complainant says, I don't agree with this, and they find out, well, neither did the accused student.
Yeah, but then for different reasons in opposing and the complaint, or the complainant agrees with it, but then the accused person actually recants and says, no, actually, I don't agree with that. And the complainant thinks they're done, and they're not.
So what you're suggesting, Ari, is pretty much the same as what Greg is suggesting. Tighten up the procedures in our office. And I'm on it.
I'm saying specifically as part of that summary decision agreement,
there's another section of the code that's about the summary decision agreement that talks about when the summary decision agreement becomes final. And it says this agreement shall not become final, or whatever, for 2 days. So I think what I'm hearing you say is incorporate in that section that agreement will not become final until the complainant is notified. And then I could go right into
saying don't make it that. That's still a little bit loose is what I'm saying is as part of that summary decision agreement meeting, it gets forwarded off to the complainant then and there. So the worst harm is that the accused person recants.
So that's a
and then the complainant
change for the logistics of the way the office operates, not a code change.
Guess it might be.
Yeah, I think that's proposed. Yeah, I mean, it's something that we've considered in...
So in the interest...
Well, it would be a little bit of a code change because it would be, instead of the final summary decision agreement being the notice point, it would be...
Notice a preliminary decision, or something like that.
So in the interest of time, and I know we're not going to accomplish the world today, of what we have to get done over the next several meetings, I'm going to propose that... Because it doesn't sound like we have a sort of a clear consensus or language. What I'm going to do is go back and, from what I've heard, sort of try to redraft something that I'll attach and submit for the group that we can then look at in a clean form and have some time to deliberate over it and then approve from there. Now that we've sort of had all the laundry aired and all the discussion and process and understanding of everything. If no one has any objection to that, that would be my recommendation that I'll go back and modify this, and then if there's no objection there, and then we can sort of circulate that, and I'll try to do this within the next few days so that we have a fair bit of lead time to
3 to 5 days.
Yeah, you'll get within 3 to 5 days.
I don't do well. So if there's no objection to that, I'd like to move on to new business just to introduce in the next 10-15 minutes the issues that we're going to come up and have to deal with around sort of the freedom of expression and the university's of property and all those sorts of things.
I apologize that I didn't hear that you have my remarks.
I do. Thank you. All right. So my agenda go. Basically, and everybody has this, and I really just kind of want to introduce
this today. And I know we're not going to get incredibly far on it. If everyone could, before next meeting, really read the report regarding the review of the November 19th protests from the president's office, if they haven't done so already. It's a fairly quick read, but nice and rich with content. One position also included multiple positions from various folks and stakeholders. Is everybody aware of the situation and sort of what the issue is?
I feel like I only have a very vague idea. I mean, I know that there was a dispute. I happened to be walking through Ville Plaza at the time it was going on, but I don't actually know what the current argument is.
Can Eric speak to that because he was there?
I'm one of the three faculty members who was interviewed in the thing.
Okay.
There's also a separate Senate committee looking into this, and I'm one of the authors of that resolution that got that separate Senate committee, as his leader was. So that committee's functioning now. They just interviewed the three of us. We do dissent from the report.
From the president's report?
Mindel's report, we feel it does not reflect any input that we gave. But as the facts and the conclusions, I'm happy to speak at that at length at some point if you want me to. There was a rally held on the November 19th, and there were two groups there. One was Students for Justice in Palestine. One was the Cornell Israeli Political Action Committee. From my perspective, that rally went on apace. There were no problems until the police showed up.
Police were there the entire time, so
until they intervened.
Well, we intervened after attempts, which isn't actually in the report, and I'm surprised it's not in the reports, with the events manager.
Oh, what is an events manager? Because I've been trying to find that out for a week.
Events managers are people that are trained to be present during controversial times or large events in general. And if disruptions occur, they're the first point of contact to try to defuse or seek compromise if there's an issue.
And just for event management from the police?
No. Student Activities Office. Student and Academic Services Office.
Susan Murphy, and they're hired by the university. They're not students.
They're secondary positions for people who are already employees here. So it's actually, I'm speaking a little out of turn. Some of them, the majority of them are from the Student and Academic Services Office. Some of them are from other positions within the university, but they're not police.
I remember one time my neighbor, Barb Abrams, who was the events manager when she worked at Cornell, and I was trying to get an understanding of what she did, and she said, well, and I don't know how accurate this is, Casey, you might know this better, she said, we tried to be sort of a mediator sort of between the protesters and the police to de-escalate any problems. That's how she thought of it. Now, I don't know if that's how it's thought
of it. And it's not even between the police. The police are actually, we're not there to do anything, but if there's crimes being committed or people getting hurt, we're there to take care of that.
I'm sure we'll get into this in lengthy
detail.
The events
manager is to identify problems, attempt to defuse the situation, give notice that the university needs to take action because of crimes that are.
And just because I know we just have a few more minutes, and I want to make sure that everybody has the opportunity to say their side and their piece, whether we agree or disagree. If we could just sort of limit the interaction, I would appreciate that. So essentially, the two groups had both decided that they were going to hold a rally.
The sequence of events is, and other people can speak to this, is that SJP had planned this rally. And they sent out posters, and it was then that CPAC decided they would show up. They used the university permit process, but they got it very quickly. If you read the explicit rules on that, there's a three-week lead time to get a university permit. This was short-circuited. They got that permit within 2 days or less over the weekend and showed up at this rally that SJP had planned and was dependent on the campus code, which allows you to come out spontaneously and demonstrate in these spaces. It's in the appendix. My perception of this and the other two faculty who were there was that the police caused the disruption. They focused on SJP, who had a legitimate right to be there, and presumably the police should know the campus code and that they had a legitimate right to be there, and finally forced SJP off of Poe Plaza.
So for the interest of this group, which is looking in at clarifying the language of the code to decide whether you need a UUP to assemble for a protest or rally, as is, and this is just myself speaking, from my understanding, the UUP is considered to be required for assemblies on that space. There's some disconnect between the understanding of the use of the university property form and process and the campus code. They don't align. So it's our job as a body to decide if we bring those into alignment, or if we write the UUP process into code, or if we go back and encourage the folks who administer the UUP to say, here's what the code says, this is what we feel the code should be, and the UUP process needs to adjust for to allow for those spontaneous demonstrations. Is that fairly?
Well, you know, from our perspective, there's no need to change the campus code. What the report does, from our perspective, is it is trying to impose a restriction on the campus code through the UUP. The report is proposing that there now be a permit process for any demonstration, that it would end spontaneous demonstrations. Our feeling is that spontaneous demonstrations are part of free speech activity, particularly here at Cornell, let's say, part of an educational process, and that hampering them with a permit puts the power of demonstration into the hands of the administration. I probably could remind everybody here that the civil rights protests were not stopped because they were civil rights protests. They were stopped because they were denied, they became violent because they were denied permits.
Which civil rights protests are you
from? Martin Luther King, you may recall those protests.
Like Selma?
You name them.
Okay, so you're not talking about a protest that...
They were denied permits.
Yeah.
And they protested anyway. Our problem with this is that if you hamper the campus code provision with a permit, what you're doing is allowing the administration to make decisions about who can and who cannot use that space. And I think that that moves against free speech, First Amendment rights, academic freedom rights,
sure, et cetera. Sure, absolutely. Reed, Lisa?
I agree with everything Eric just said. I have a process piece that I want to put in because I'm guessing that you only have a few minutes left.
Yes.
Okay. All right. So the process piece is this. As this long discussion that you just went through about the 2 days versus 5 days shows, you need a full hearing on issues and you need to have all the facts, right, on relatively simple points. And so the process piece that I would like to ask this group to consider is to suspend looking at this question any further until such time as the Faculty Senate Investigation Committee, which is doing its work, as Eric said, until they have a chance to finish their investigation, write a report, and make recommendations, so that when you look at the questions, you have more than Mingle's report, which did not interview any of the students, which did not interview any people who are experts in academic freedom, which did not reflect, right, except for, but not a bad academic freedom, and you didn't get to put your stuff in, and did right. not reflect the points that Eric raised. So it seems to me that the point is you have a very partial view. And what's important to do, knowing that the Faculty Senate Investigating Committee is doing this work right now, it seems to me, is to wait until you have reports and a full statement of the report.
What is the
and then
timeline for that?
I think it'll be pretty soon. But no matter what the timeline is, why would you do this when you have the President's report and not the Faculty Senate's report?
Because we also have our independent way of thinking. We're looking at the President's report as
one piece.
As one piece.
Because this,
totally,
the, re-
Yes.
I was going to say, for me, I've thought about free speech and academic freedom
for decades.
And in terms of, I asked what an event manager is. I called up Dean's student's office a week ago to find out what an events manager was. I said, whoa, you better go to the top, and they referred me to Susan Murphy's office. I still haven't gotten a report from Susan Murphy's office. And today, just I have my computer open to see if I get an email from Jim Mingle or Jane Miller asking them what an events manager is. So they're certainly not standing behind their own report,
right,
as far as I'm concerned.
Right. I think that you should feel independent
in asking any questions.
Yeah. I'm not inserting. All I'm saying is that it seems to me that as a matter of logic, it makes sense to say let the committees that are doing the work finish it. You might then have further questions based on what the faculty.
Well, we may also dig up stuff that the faculty committee
doesn't do. Just to clarify, we are one of the committees doing the work on this, because we are tasked by the University Assembly, which is composed of all constituent groups,
right,
to evaluate this. So we are one committee. While the faculty can do their investigation, and we're welcome to that sort of input, we also, I think, can do our own as well, and include that as part of the process.
So are you saying you would also investigate factually what happened as a committee?
I think we need to. Our task is to look at the code and what the code says, and make decisions on the code. I think that this was an event that triggered looking at the code, and I think what we need to do is look at what the code says and how it represents various interests from all different constituent groups which are represented around the table, and make decisions on that. But it's not to make findings on this specific event.
Right. So I'm wondering why you would bother having the president's report at all.
A great question.
To, I guess, understand and the ambiguities in the code and how the code had a role in causing this.
From one perspective, such as I included several other perspectives in that email.
But you don't have the perspective that you know will come. So I'm just talking about timing.
But you have to, when I wrote to Eric and Yuval, two vocal people on both sides of that issue in the same email. So it was clear. I'm really interested in getting whatever facts from the people that were there. I'm only one person on this committee, but I really want to know what's important, be able to make a decision what's important, but cast a wide net. Last president I really liked was Jeff Lehman. it's just a report. It's just a report. It will influence us for how we all decide to let it influence us.
And then Peter.
Yeah, I have concerns that we're going to have a lot of constraints. The issue is not by any means fixed, and it's going to crop up again, whether it's this issue or another issue. We disagree on facts, and that's fine. And I agree with that this body is charged with looking at the code to see if it does represent free speech in a consistent way. Whether it's fair or not, I guess we have to discuss. But the point that were brought forward in the president's report that I think that this body is to consider is whether or not a permit is required, and if it is, what's that time frame and when it needs to get it. I can speak to the history of how there are many, many unpermitted spontaneous protests that have happened on this campus. What happened in this particular case is we had a body that had, quote, rights to the private space, which is Cornell University, and had followed a process, and we had a body that had not followed that process but had rights by other parts of the code, and then there was a dispute amongst the groups, and then there was an ask for us to help mediate that dispute.
Who asked?
The group that had the permit on the scene.
I don't want to get into
we try to just keep the parties going, and if they can do that in a peaceful and calm way, that was great. That is not the case of what was going on the
scene. That's the major disagreement.
Yeah.
That is, I think, a significant disagreement. We feel that they were, there was certainly noisy, but noise is not an act of violence, and it's part of free speech. But there was no confrontation, not at all. And I was standing right in the middle.
Sure.
Of this, where the other
and again, I don't.
Here's the problem.
Hold on one second.
Campus, this issue would not have come up. The campus code. Nobody's questioned the campus code, as far as I know, until this moment. This issue would not have come up unless it was generated by the president's report, which is only one perspective on this event. So it wouldn't have come up.
Absolutely. And
the question is, why does it come up at all? It comes up because somebody is claiming that there was somehow that there was some jeopardy was being caused, that there was a problem in allowing both these groups to be there. We're claiming that isn't the case. We're claiming that was manufactured.
And so what we're doing from the University of the Assembly's perspective is we're looking at this in the Codes and Judicials Committee as that language is represented in the code. And we will consider all of the parties, and we will let all folks come to the table and express their opinion on the code. And I think we'll talk about as a group in sort of an executive session what we want to limit. But it would be my personal interest that we limit specifics of the event to more the expression of speech and things like that in the code and talk about it in a way less specifically because I don't want to have a protest in this room, and I don't want to have spontaneous combustions of things like that, because I don't want that to take place, and I want there to be order and things like that. Unfortunately, due to time, we've reached our limit. What I would ask the members of the committee is, in the interest of many topics that we have to discuss, if we wouldn't mind, with the next meeting, rather than scheduling another one, members of the committee, if we could extend, and what we would do is I would limit the next meeting to the members of the committee so that we can talk about sort of a game plan and strategy and discuss there, because I think we've had the viewpoints from the first resolution we had, and then talk about inviting various folks in at a future date to talk about it and sort of present any opinion that they would like to have. So
you would not need our offices.
I would not need your offices.
Will the next meeting be during spring break?
That could very well be the case.
I'll be here.
I won't.
It is scheduled for the 19th.
But I think we should absolutely wait for this faculty senate report before we go ahead and make any decisions or either further conversation.
So
I think we're not making an educated decision if we don't have that.
Here's what I'm going to propose we talk about. I want to talk about the process in which we want to tackle these issues at hand, and that opinion will be part of that process discussion. So I guess the next meeting is during spring break, so that rules out undergrads, essentially.
I would hope that you would wait to vote on anything until, like, there could be a diverse body voting on it.
And I wouldn't.
Okay.
I wouldn't propose voting.
Just going to throw that out there for the spring break thing. I wouldn't want.
Maybe we could arrange for a meeting that's outside of the regular schedule. But
yeah, I'll look and see if I can propose
anything
something
with that.
next week, potentially.
I just want to say I actually think it should be an open meeting, just because this is transparency is a way to say I have no integrity, and I could call it transparency. And I think the university is not transparent. We got an award for Milstein being transparent. That's the university transparency. And I would like to have anybody that feels they have a stake in this.
But here's the thing, we're not talking about the issue. This is more of a process meeting for us to understand how we would like to move forward. And I don't want to talk about facts or things like that. I want to talk about is this something we want to bring up? Because at the end of the day, a code change has to come from a member of the UA, has to present the resolution. So I want to talk, is this even something we should be talking about? Because it was suggested that we do talk about it, but we can also say we don't want to talk about it. So that's where I want to have, without multiple folks sort of injecting whatever the opinion might be, I want to have a voting sort of member meeting to sort of discuss that.
I would like to suggest then we have a compromise that we have a half a meeting.
Yes, absolutely.
To get together with that, and then the other half of the meeting be open to,
of course,
to anybody.
Are you kind of bifurcating the issue that's the new issue and the issue we discussed primarily today? I'm just confused. Will you be voting on the resolution?
At some point, we will be voting on the resolution that was brought up.
And is that not what we're going to be there for?
If we're voting on that, I'll make sure that we include both of your offices.
Can I get another plug in since we have some new folks here? There is a mailing list where announcements of agendas and materials for each CJC meeting should be posted. I don't know if you're on it. You can subscribe to it by sending an email to cjc-info-subscribe.
Yeah, we got that information. Thanks. Are there provisions for when this committee is in executive session? I'm really asking because I don't know.
All right. We would have to look them up. It's very rare, so.
Right, because my assumption was that executive sessions are for confidential information. So it seems to me that there is some question. I mean, process is, as we all know, very substantive. We talk about things as process, but it always has substance. So I would certainly urge you to consider what Randy has said about openness.
And I'm fine with openness as long as there's a process that's followed. For folks who want to speak. And then maybe I'll, in the next meeting, clarify that process and more strictly adhere to a speaker's list and things like that so that we don't sort of lose off track and have interjections and back and forth. Because I'm fine with openness and transparency as long as there's process involved in that as well.
That's something you can do.
Yeah.
Well, I'd also like to not go off topic and be talking about things that have no purview and that this has no scope over. There are other forums for that and there are other places.
It is, I believe it is the prerogative of the committee to go into executive session and that there are specific rules about that in Robert's order. So I will study up on that and make sure that we know what the rules are.
And by no means is that idea to go into executive session to limit anyone's involvement in the process. My goal is so that members of the committee can decide what our process moving forward may be without having interjections from folks not outside the committee in ways that may provide unproductive for some members. Mm-hmm. That's my only desire. Right.
I think a structural mistake that's often made in the university is saying, okay, that's the past, let's go on from here. And I actually think that academic freedom is the main issue here, not the protest that we're involved in. But sometimes you need to discuss the past in order to just put it behind and then say, this is actually what we're all here for. So for cutting things off too soon, I think we always make that mistake. And we have a chance of not making that mistake here.
I should say that we stressed in the Senate that this was not about Palestine and Israel.
Yeah, right.
We stressed in the Senate that it was about how free speech would proceed on the Cornell campus and in accordance with what rules. We're not interested in rehashing that particular debate whatsoever.
I think that they've been having that trouble for years and years. I don't know that we'll solve it here in our little corner.
No, that's not our point. We're very concerned about these issues.
Yeah. I'm going to move to adjourn the meeting.
All right, good afternoon, everyone, if we can get started. Today is Wednesday, March 6th, meeting of the Employee Assembly, 12:20 p.m. Are there any late additions to the agenda? No. Okay. Just one quick announcement. We've got a couple of guests with us here today. First is Joe Rogan, right? I got it right? Who will be a new Employee Assembly member starting in the June term. So he's joined us today just to start getting a sense of what it is we do. We also have with us Ulysses Smith, who's going to give a presentation on the Student Assembly Diversity Plan, and Jonathan Saltman, who's here to talk with us a little bit about the United Way.
Sorry, I know you went so quickly through the agenda.
Sorry.
Chairwoman, is there time to add a couple minutes to the CARE Fund update?
Yes, we can.
And I apologize in advance that there's even at 1:10 for another meeting.
Okay. Okay, so moving right along, if we can quickly take a look at the meeting minutes. Does anyone have any additions, changes to the minutes? No. Okay. Having heard no objections, I'd like to move that we approve the minutes for last meeting. All in favor?
Aye.
Great. Thank you. All right. So our first speaker for today is Ulysses.
Okay.
So if you want to go ahead and share with us the Student Assembly's Diversity Initiative.
Hopefully my energy will stay up there. It's just finishing an election, but it's been a brilliant 2 weeks of madness. But my name is Lisa Smith. I serve as the new Vice President of Diversity and Inclusion on the Student Assembly. And this is the final assembly I have to visit this plan. So basically what we did was we created a couple of new positions, a couple of new committees, and then a plan to go along with that. This plan is actually, it follows the same pattern as Portland Destination, which is the university diversity plan. I mean, people have heard of that, aware of it. If not, you should probably investigate that a little bit more. So basically, I just kind of want to run through what it is exactly that we're doing and why we're doing it, and so maybe encourage you all to do the same thing in terms of, in effect, to become better representatives of the conservative community. So, I'm not going to go through all this, but the first thing we did was create a new executive board position. Some people might think, well, why in the world would you want to create a position that in a sense tokenizes diversity and inclusion? It makes one person that same person. Now all of my boys are going to go apply to this position. Well, in theory, all of our representatives should be thinking about diversity and inclusion when they are writing their initiatives, when they are actively engaging with different audiences. To come up with those initiatives, in theory. However, we've seen in practice that has not necessarily been the case. So the assembly, though we pushed out some pretty significant and great initiatives, we've seen policies that are not very informed and are not very inclusive in nature. And this points to a larger flaw on our behalf that we have not actively engaged as many different audiences as we could have in terms of actually coming up with those initiatives. The first thought that a lot of us have is never, oh, this is such a great idea that we have. Let me find somebody who disagrees with me and actually engage them in this conversation. That's never the first thought we have. Our first thought is always, wow, let's go find somebody who agrees. Let's find that one person bring them to the table so we can say, all of them disagree with this. But then we haven't really discussed how this new housing policy, for instance, will affect people who are going to continue occupancy in the other program houses. So we also needed a link between the assembly and the new Office of Academic Diversity. All of our executive board positions have a link to one of the different offices around here. And so we thought it was pertinent at this point that we actually established that link so we are much more informed about the different university initiatives that are coming down in that regard. So it's basically my job description now, part of it anyway. So the next thing that we did was actually create this plan. And we followed exactly the same procedures that according to Destination. We looked at the four different categories: composition, inclusion, engagement, and achievement. And we chose five definitions, with one of them being composition. And so the first one, which really came to all of them, is we need to increase our target pipeline. We had never actively gone to first year students before they come here to PSP program, for instance, to get students more actively engaged and involved in the shared governance system before they actually stepped on the Cornell campus. We had a problem with not really relaying, assemblies in general have a problem with not really relaying to certain communities how the actions of the assembly are relevant to their community. And so in that regard, we haven't seen a lot of participation from different minority communities across the country. And now we're seeing that now. So not only are we doing more to engage pre-freshmen when they come here by doing presentations at your university hosting like and your CSP, but we're also redoing our committee section and doing more targeted outreach to different communities to actually tell them about the community that we have and what they do. The two engagement pieces are really, one focuses on, strengthening that and standardizing our practices for actually measuring how inclusive our policies actually are. That has proven to be a challenge. Standardizing and measuring is always a challenge, so we're working with Lisa Nelson Burrow, Fly Mata, people from OADI to kind of help us figure out some sort of metrics to actually look at that. But that is going to be, that's been my big challenge this year. And then the other one, I'm sure that you've read the sign of the past few weeks. A few weeks ago, there was a big blow up about the social justice requirement, which does not exist. There is no proposal, has never been a proposal. There's only information that we put out there about it. But we did, the company we did establish a diversity affairs coalition, which takes the student assembly into a realm where we traditionally have not been involved, and that is the realm of academia. Shocking, since that is the primary reason all students are here, is to focus on academics. But when it comes to curriculum changes and things like that, students are never really involved or engaged in that process, and we kind of wonder why. If we want to talk about the student experience, nobody knows the student experience better than the students, so it just kind of blew our mind when nobody was asking us. So this coalition, which will actually be meeting on Friday, comprises students from two representatives for students from every single college, and also a staff member who, in most cases, a college associate, who is tasked with dealing with a lot of diversity and inclusion initiatives of those colleges. And it brings them together so we can talk about a lot of the things on the college level that are focused on diversity and inclusion. So, for instance, it made no sense why the College of Engineering has been awarded by the President of the United States for its diversity programming and advising structures, and that just is non-existent in arts and sciences and in environmental school, right? So hopefully we'll get some great issues coming out of that. We have an inclusive book policy that we're looking at now, among other things. So that's that. And the last two initiatives will focus on the inclusion piece, which is really pertinent to all assemblies. Talking about diversity, well, diversity itself is not an issue, but there are even topics associated with it that are issues. And oftentimes it's very, very difficult to have these types of discussions. Things can get heated, things can get very uncomfortable, but we learned and we realized that in order for us to better engage with our constituents, we need to understand first each other's differences. We need to understand how to actually talk across those differences. Otherwise, we're doing a disservice by going out into the community and not being able to facilitate those types of conversations in order to help, or to help other students think about, you know, the other perspectives of other people before they make certain decisions. So we're working to do that, and we actually had a unity hour. We put a fund to the unity hour with Ujma to kind of talk about that along with the academic side. We also have, we're co-sponsoring an event on March 11th with Office of Active Diversity Initiatives called the Social Justice Roundtable. It's one of their series. And we're talking about, are the assemblies as a whole, are we actually a helping hand or a hindrance to achieving for students and other individuals across campus of achieving justice, getting their voices actually heard. So that should be very interesting, and I'm sure we'll get a lot of criticism, and I'm open to hearing it. And then the final part of it is simply to create different action plans for all of our categories of representatives, so whether that's at-large representatives with target constituencies like the LGBT community, or the college representatives, and then undesignated at large. So they each know what their responsibilities are, they know the resources that are available to them, and they know kind of the offices to point people to go to in order to help get a lot of their initiatives done in more than a specific manner. So with that, pretty much, that's the Diversity Fair Coalition, which is not going to be done, but those are the 5 points of it, and that's just something that I described earlier. And if there's some questions about the effect.
Yeah, a couple different ones. One for clarification, the measure of classifying, you use the terminology underrepresented and minority both interchangeably and together in the one slide. And I want to make sure I'm understanding this correctly. Is the contemporary term really using that it's not offensive, using the term underrepresented and not minority?
It depends on who you talk to.
Yes,
that's right. It depends on who you talk to. So, for instance, I know when we measure pronoun measures, we don't include Asians in the underrepresented or minority. I can't remember.
You can't go with college.
Yeah.
See, so there's inconsistency. That's what I'm trying to drive at. So, and in fact, and I mean, it's the same thing. Like, the university does not have one definition of this. It's very difficult for us to actually define that, which in some senses is a good thing, because we're not limited. But at the same time, it's very difficult to establish that consistency that we're talking about. So sometimes, I know a lot of times we do say minority, and then, of course, everybody has their own information of who exactly that is.
Right.
But we have two minority representatives on the student assembly who don't technically have a specific constituency. So history has shown that they've been much more receptive to black students, international students, those communities, as opposed to really addressing the issues of women, for instance.
Right.
So
that's what I'm driving at. I would just say, just to go back to the very beginning of the basics in the university system and different metrics, I would almost make sure we don't make assumptions. We actually set the legend or the key, the terminology straight with, are we talking about a certain category? Because then you think about the Asian student population, and some metrics, they're not underrepresented or they're not a minority, or like you just said, gender. Because then you'll have a better, I think, as you have your megaphone, you amplify your message, success and change. I think you need everyone to be on the same first page. That's just a recommendation to you that I know.
I fairly agree. That's
if it helps you at all, I think that so that yeah. One slide, you actually mix them together, this and that, and then what exactly, what population are we talking about, and what is it comprised of?
Absolutely. And I thought that has been like the most difficult challenge, even relying on administrators that kind of help give us that information to start with. I think nobody seems to have a consistent position anywhere across the university with those essential aspects.
So how do you really know who you're representing?
Exactly. And it's been, we're still trying to figure that out.
I wanted to give you my card and
oh, that sounds fantastic. Absolutely.
Other questions? Thoughts? Comments? Felix, I guess the one question that I have is how can we, as the EA, kind of help you guys? Is there anything that you would, that we can help do?
Sure. Well, AC was told me when we first communicated with their office, he told us that we were the first assembly that was actually doing this and thinking about it. And he was hoping that all the other assemblies would get on board. I'm not sure how the employee assembly process works. I'm not sure what I remember them. I'm like, who is that? So I'm not sure exactly who, in fact, we should be representing. But I do think it would help if the assemblies kind of got on the United Front. And first, if they need to try to come up with, establish who exactly we're representing, try to better engage in those conversations. I don't think the various assemblies actually engage with each other enough regarding all these different issues, because a lot of the things that the assemblies, that the student assembly passes, affect the workload of staff members, or affect the way faculty might have to do something, and we don't actually communicate that to faculty or employees, or even the UA, in some cases. But I think that would really be helpful. And really, again, talking across a lot of those differences and maybe establishing their own plan. I don't know if you guys, I'm sure you guys don't really have a designated person office person or anything like that. But if there would be, if there was somebody that we could communicate with specifically about this, that would be fantastic.
Okay. Great. Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Thank you. So next up, we have Jonathan here. And Jonathan, do you want to explain a little bit about, I haven't given the group really any background about.
Yeah, absolutely. So my name is Jonathan Sultan. I'm a second year graduate fellow with the Cornell Institute for Public Affairs. And right now, what I'm with you nice people about today is that I'm working with the Cornell United Way campaign, essentially, through the service exchange from CIPA. And what we're trying to address is now a lack in faculty participation within the Cornell United Way campaign. And it's becoming an issue because right now Cornell has about a 13-17% participation rate among its faculty, and that rate is actually decreasing over time, opposed to increasing, whereas our peer campaigns have around 30 to 40%. And right now, the United Way of Tompkins County, we are designated to, we typically provide about 40% of their total funding, which with United Way, if you, I'm not sure if you know about it, United Way works with a whole bunch of local charities within our region to help out the people of Ithaca. So it really works with about 40 different charities around Ithaca to help out the people of Ithaca. So it really goes back to our own community. And so we're trying to address why our faculty, that it would actually help, or in some way, whether it's their community or directly, are not actually participating. So we, in that sense, we had a few questions that we're trying to address. And basically, I know as I'm an alumni of Cornell myself, and we do get emails, a lot of many similar emails that many of the employees do. And I know that there's one that goes out to the employees every year that talks about United Way. But again, we also know that many people choose not to give to charities or whoever you decide to give to because you aren't well informed about it. I'm wondering if you actually do feel well informed about United Way and if you contribute, why or why not? And in your opinion, why don't Cornell staff do? I know I've also been a participant, I've worked with the Cornell Annual Fund since I was an undergrad. And there are many different reasons why people don't give, especially to Cornell. So we're wondering if having Cornell specifically add itself as Cornell United Way is a bias in that sense, in your opinion. Do you feel that Cornell is too aggressive about it? Is there a lack of information, or is there anything more that Cornell could do? I know that we do have the thermometer just in front of the Big Red Barn, but that's about it right now for what Cornell United Way does about advertising around campus, besides the about yearly message from President Scorton, which I'm sure many of you have read up. So we're wondering basically what your ideas are, essentially, on it. Should there be more branding, messaging, anything that we can do or not do to increase the participation rate among employees and our faculty, and basically what information you would want to know about United Way that would really help you decide.
Bill, do you have questions? Or you just... Okay, I just didn't know if you had a thing.
I have a comment though, and I can confirm this one. I don't give it.
Absolutely, we're looking for
the reason I don't give is I don't have the expendable cash. Mm-hmm. I can't speak to anybody other than that.
That's the same with me.
Something that might help tug at the heartstrings of others and myself would be possibly a compelling story or two from President Trump on where the funding went and how it helps a specific individual or group of people and where that money actually goes and how a contribution can really actually affect them.
I would piggyback off of Bill's say that in the world of fundraising, I think you're going to have a lot of white noise competing against many wonderful causes. Mm-hmm. So if you take the donor's shoes model, and the United Way Cornell had a donor's shoes type model that I might be able to impact a specific, you said that the United Way covers about 20 or 30 agencies in town allocating funds, but everyone in here has different affinities and relationships and different causes. I mean, drilling down to where they get dispersed and maybe having a direct impact in that cash allocation might help, because everyone has, that's just my opinion on the tough market where somebody's in the larger cities.
For example, if I gave money and my personal choice of giving money to a SPCA and an entity, you know, I gave it to the United Way, and I knew that the United Way gave, you know, X number of dollars to save the cute little puppy, it would, I think, bolster your efforts to deal with
study.
See, exactly.
This dollar helps feed this dog for the day.
Can I clarify your question? When you said only 14% of faculty, does that also include staff?
Yeah.
Also faculty and staff.
And I was just wondering if my study tends to be increasing all the time, like since when, like since the economy started to buckle, or
really it's been for the past several years, looking for the reason that might very well be part of it.
And then, Cornell's historically low.
It's never been very high, but especially anywhere near our peer campaign. And by peer campaigns, I mean in other universities around the country and within New York State, Rochester, Purdue, Miami, they all have their own campaigns, as well as the other Ivies that we're looking to. We're addressing them as well as what they've done well and what they haven't, what their faults have been. But we're also wondering what you guys think.
I think Greg had a question and then Bridget.
I guess one of my questions is, and I'm only speaking from sort of my hearsay knowledge of United Way, but it seems like there's a very heavy administrative cost that the United Way carries. And I'd be curious to know what percentage of the gift is actually going to a charity. Mm-hmm.
I could answer that 100%.
So that I'll write that down. That's not.
Yeah, because that's a big. That's a
yeah.
Big unit,
the best part about having Cornell run it is that Cornell.
So to clarify, there is an administrative cost that is paid for by the university, but 100% of donations
goes to the United Way.
Yes.
My question is, as once the dollar hits the United Way, what percentage of the United Way's dollar is carried by their sort of overhead? Their senior leadership salaries, their staff, what dollar actually, or what percentage of that dollar actually makes it to an organization?
100%.
Their operating costs are completely covered by Cornell. And you can choose which organization that I was on the United Way Center, sorry if I'm cutting it. We were passionate about it. But you can choose how you want to allocate. My fund that I give, and I gave the most I've ever given this year, I've split between three different. One, the general fund, which allows them to kind of give to where it needs. And then two causes that I feel very passionately about. So that's the nice thing. You can really choose how you want to fund your foundation. And know what 100% goes there, but there's no overhead. Cornell and I think a couple other organizations in town all contribute to pick up the complete administrative costs of the operations of the United Way for Thompson County, all the salaries, all the other things.
So what about the people who don't live in Thompson County?
You can donate to your other county. Yep.
And will that still count?
Yes.
Right. Hang on. We've got Bridget. And then.
Yeah. I just wanted to add that everybody's brought up all the points that I would have made, too. First, it's expendable cash. And I think a lot of it has to do with the dynamics in this county, taxes and the town gown issues that we face as employees. Just, a lot of the families are just struggling. Even though they're working, a lot of people are struggling. The other issue was there's also very good other organizations, and I think that are unique to Ithaca. A couple that I support are the Children's Garden and the Parents Reading Partnership. There's a lot of good organizations already that people are, donating to. The third thing I wanted to ask was, in my department, it seems like there's a fair amount of follow-up to the point of someone's literally tracking whether you've donated or not and replied. And I don't know if that's across the board at Cornell. Mm. And my department there might have been some kind of connection going on there, and maybe that's why it was happening. But I did find that very interesting that if you did not return your donation card, you got a follow up.
But did you find that offensive or encouraging?
A little, it's hard. I have mixed feelings about it because part of me kind of feels like, well, I guess that's good, but part of me is just like, with any other organization, if you give to NPR, I'm happy to give, but I hate it that a month later they're asking for more. And I just kind of feel like, if
you
I could have gave
very mental with DVD, though, when you did it.
It's probably, I'm thinking maybe like a 3 week time period.
Yeah, the same thing.
Okay, so there it is. It is. Okay.
Seems like the second thing you have to be persistent about if you're trying to garner donations.
Well, actually, that's one of the issues we're trying to address. It does work for some people, but other people it's offensive. So that's actually why I asked that you think Cornell's participation is biasing, potentially, in that sense, or if it's offensive. Because I know, especially through my experiences with the Cornell Annual Fund, that is a major issue among our alumni, is that we fall too much. Or else we do follow up without the lack of, if you don't fill out your card or all of that. So that is an issue that we're trying to address. I'm trying to figure out essentially how much follow-up is necessary. Mm.
Jeannie?
Okay, so I have no expendable cash, but I give every year because I am time lazy. In like, I'm not going to go and plant flowers at the children's garden. So it's my easy button to give the United Way. So that's my reality. But I think just what people are saying here, this is a very well-informed group. And if this well-informed group doesn't know simple answers, then how you're communicating is somehow not working. And I don't know whether it's the agencies that you represent have an open house and you go to each department on campus and say, this is what we do. I have no idea necessarily how you communicate better, but if this group who is trying to keep tabs on what's going on campus don't have kind of the basic facts, that's kind of telling. I don't know what it tells you, but it tells you something.
Linda?
Yeah, I mean, I've said it a few years in a row, and it doesn't really seem to, I don't know whether it's a lack of time or another case, but when I moved here from New York City, I was the chair of the United Way Food Corporation I worked for. And within 1 year's time, I increased our donations by 40%. And the way that I did that is right before, the month or so before we started asking for a fund, I worked with several agencies in the Federal Bureau of New York City, and we had about 20 agencies across the city, and we did a half a volunteer day of our employees who went out and volunteered in all these agencies. So they got firsthand knowledge. And so many of the people were so impacted by that half day of volunteer time that they gave. And, you know, I personally, the first time I ever gave, which was many years ago now, I had gone to a volunteer day like that to reach children today. And that next staff, I was right on top of making sure I sent money to make sure that they had more books and videos and everything for the kids at that center of home. So I think if there's a way to engage through some volunteer activity where people actually get to see, I think maybe what you had mentioned, to see how that money in a very first-hand way, and I think building on Dean's point, I'm the same way. I don't have time to be going to food kitchens. I've got three kids with schedules that I don't even see my husband right now. We are in opposite directions, carting kids everywhere. And so for me, that's why I gave him up my day this year, because that's the only way I can give back right now. I would love to be volunteering. I just don't have a minute to do it. And so having had that annual volunteer experience in the work day, and it's still in sort of way, through my work, I was able to see that person, and it made me want to give. So that was one thing I suggested a few years in a row now, of is there some way that Cornell could do some sort of volunteer day to the department, who can go down and paint a shelter for a couple of hours, or, you know, but during the work day, you know, or even do it in shifts, you know, where small impact groups can go do that so that they can see it firsthand. We'll be giving back to the community in terms of our hours, and then people will remember that when it comes time to donate. Because they'll say, that was really great, but how can I find to do that? Or they may decide to start donating their time. So that was just, it really worked. 40% increase, I saw in giving after doing that. 40% increase.
Thank you, Linda. Greg?
I think that's a great point, and I think it plays on an interesting the idea. You know, Cornell had for a while, a couple of years back, a time, talent, or treasure. You know, which way can you sort of get? And I think it would be interesting to see maybe United Way maybe put out some more opportunities for people who maybe don't have the cash or aren't able to make that financial gift, but say, you know, I've got an hour or two, or I've got 5 hours, or I've got whatever I have and I can go give, or I have these materials at my home that maybe I can provide that I don't need anymore, and looking for other ways to give and look at tracking participation that way. I know it's a fundraising organization, you want to raise funds, but I think if you can also raise awareness and involvement and get creative about ways people can participate and not feel like they're always having to give that dollar, but they can give in ways that they can, I think might be beneficial, and in the long run, probably see some payback financially.
Mm-hmm. Are there thoughts or comments?
I have one more thought, and I don't know how, I know like in our department, when there's like the local tragedy of a flood or whatever, and people get fired up and I want to help, if somehow in those instances in the United Way is somehow involved, if people were aware that their gift from United Way was actually helping the people wherever who just experienced this tragedy, like the CARE Fund, you feel a more direct connection because you know somebody, one of your neighbors that may have written in and received some money, so that it's not so obscure and connected to things that are happening right here that people are wanting to help with.
Maybe some articles just offering to help you.
The common theme that I'm hearing out of like out of the really good ideas is how do you build rapport, which is something you do at least in some capacity of being in person, whether it be over the phone or face to face. So how do you build rapport with an entire community where you can't possibly meet everybody? And I think that the stuff where you volunteer builds rapport with a network who has connections outside the network, and then what Dean was saying is just a way that you can build rapport with people who you're probably not even, I think, is a tricky sort of task that is requires a creative solution. The other thing I wanted to mention was just we talked briefly about you know, how much communication is too much and stuff like that. You know, if mailings are something I have direct oversight on, that's my full-time job. So, you know, one thing you can do is just say, I do not wish to give. Do you have an option like that? And then if people send those back, you know, you can stop mailing those people. If you're worried about sending people too much and being a pest, but my guess is you see, you know, most donations back from your initial mailing, and then you see subsequent donations back on your subsequent mailings, and you know, it's not exactly the type of thing you want to decrease your number of mailings over time if you can have those people. Which is why I do it.
What if you were to do a mailing that was like a video, and at the beginning of the campaign that people could watch a short YouTube style that just kind of spent a minute or two going to some different people and scenarios and seeing actual people who just spend, you know, a couple minutes going to different agencies on how it's impacted them. You know, I was able to get the transcript that I really needed. I didn't have the money, but the prescription funds from the United Way was able to allow me to be able to get the go up to the FPPA, we were able to feed the dogs because of the total amount that went out donated. And just did that in like 1 or 2 minutes kind of thing that would go out with the cars or somewhere electronically a link to it of how we impacted our community this last year. That would tie into the emotional part of the beginning, but I think it's the piece that people, that connection, that human connection, that I think is lost in the city.
Yeah, and that's the one communication that you're getting a year is just that piece of paper and that email, and you're getting that at a time where you're also hearing your health insurance is going up, and you just found out you didn't, you know, the raise was minimal, and
your taxes are going up and all of that. And, you know, people are really struggling, and I think that the United Way needs to acknowledge that in some way, that we're all struggling. Some of us may be struggling less than others, but everyone's struggling. I think the staff far more than the faculty probably, but...
then you tap into the competitive nature.
Right.
The people who aren't struggling put out there what all the other Ivies are doing and say.
I mean, because it is really challenging. I mean, I give, but every year I have to wrestle with saying, do I give to this or do I give this to my family or my children? And eventually at some point it's going to come down to, I can't give this bit anymore. I've got to put it over here. And I think that's where a lot of people are right now. So. Yes. And they're all in college at the same time.
Ready to go to college.
Well, thank you all for your input. We have a lot of notes to go through. I'll definitely update you once we go through our whole campaign of figuring this out. If you have any other ideas or just want to email me personally with anything that you think or have, think of anything further, I have a sign-up sheet. If you're not at me, I'll contact you. You can also take down my email address, which is jvs295@cornell.edu. Now, I'm on top of my email. I'll definitely get back to you. Any input you have is definitely very much appreciated. Thank you.
Thank you.
So, one quick thing, Jonathan. 2 years, was it 3 years ago we handed out the cards at our president's address?
Mm-hmm.
Do you know how that resulted in more people signing up?
I don't remember. I don't remember.
We brought cards. I mean, you were at an event and you could hand out cards and they hadn't filled one out, fill it out now. And I think some people stopped.
Yeah, we had some people do cards, and we also just had a box there essentially that people could just drop a dollar in or whatever. You know, just saying, okay, I can't make this commitment, but I can throw in a buck or $5 or whatever. So those may be things you want to think about as well, like Jeremy said, with sporting events and things like that. Well, thank you. So before I move into report from the chair, because Joe, I know you have to leave, do you want to update on the CARE Fund?
Oh, sure. Thanks for... And it's a good segue from fundraising.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. So where we are with the CARE Fund was... just hearing how much it's helped people, and we have a couple members that are on the allocation committee. Just wanted to try and do one thing and make it successful while I'm on the assembly. So, with the help of Tanya and Bridget, I was able to get on Mary Opperman's docket last week for about 10 minutes. And what I presented was the original slide you have. Thank you for printing this out. The actual version on the computer shows all three circles, but I was just trying to endow at 100,000 each to try and get 5% operating. You get 5% of the amount towards the annual, why am I blank for words? I'm sorry, let me start over. Where we are is I was trying to get the endowment, the CARE Fund endowed, because every year it's a fundraising event. The amount of dollars has gone down from the hard work of our colleagues doing the auction. And Mary Opperman's office has dumped in, buckets of money, buckets of cash every year. So kind of a way to solve this is if we come up with a number that would be sustainable every year, driven off the endowment funds, we wouldn't have to do fundraising every year that would be starting at ground zero. It would just be going into the fund and increasing the endowment allocation. So typically an endowment, when you endow a professorship or a scholarship, it's 5%. So if we endow $500,000, that 5% would yield $25,000 every single year for the committee to allocate to the different people that need it in the community. currently all faculty and staff benefits on this. After meeting with Mary Opperman, it was a very nice 10-15 minute meeting. Our next meeting is this Friday with Charlie Flegler. That's right, Flegler. Charlie's the head of development for all of Cornell. And Alan's not here, but Alan Mittman's in the loop. What we're going to do is, Mary liked the idea, and please chime in if you disagree, we're there together. Mary liked the idea of not every year having to tap in budget buckets of money to just go in this, not this pit, because it's for a good cause, but not the replenishing. Was if we got the administration, meaning the Cornell leadership, which includes all deans from all units and above, this was Mary's endorsement too, was we get $250,000 established from them, and then we go to the trustees, which, by the way, we'll get to see the trustees individually on the 27th for breakfast, so at your own leisure, you can talk about this with that. You get $500,000, and then you dump in the contributions. You're going to be able to sustain itself and fund it every year. The goal is ambitious, but reasonable. Since we're doing budgets right now, and it's very clear, the goal is to do it for this coming fiscal year, July 1. And, you know, it doesn't mean we don't do fundraising, it doesn't mean anything, but it just means that we can take a deep breath and every year have a nice bucket of money to allocate. Is there anything else that I missed?
No. Mary was very supportive.
She ran with it.
Yep.
Yeah, and our initial goal was lower, and she suggested going for $500,000. So
how do we campaign for that?
We're not. We're just going to move forward and plow ahead and then leverage Mary with Charlie and then leverage all that with David Scorton. And then, you know, it's such a good cause. It really comes out of like a trustee challenge. So when you work with development, they create the endowed fund, and we just work work the angle with the administrators of Cornell to just do this goodwill, because a couple things real quickly I pitched was, not only is it good for the school and the faculty and the benefactors and staff, it's good PR for the University of the Crown Jewel of Higher Ed for the right reasons. It's, as you hear, challenging times is trying to raise money. There's all kinds of good affinities there. It's just a good, well-around thing. And then we won't have to every year be this fund that, oh, can you put $25,000 in your bucket? So it's kind of, once you take the big plunge, we're done. And that was, so I'm not there yet knowing the full,
right.
Well, that's what we're doing. Just, and so we don't have to go to the resolution strategy yet. Nothing against that, but you know what I mean? We'll do a little more soft arm than harder.
And so none of this initial fund will be created by any of the people on the ground, anybody with no badges coming from the people.
Today, the fund is already set up for the
well, I'm talking about the endowed portion of it.
Well, no, we would certainly ask staff and faculty and folks at the university to give along with, but...
So the seed money needs to be the $500,000.
So if we get $5,000 from staff, that will go in the bucket with these other big things. But these are the asks to those two big components.
Yeah, make them commit, get it created. Charlie creates the gap. And then right now, if you go to the website, it's a great website that's set up for the care fund. It already has direct deposit and other other features. So the infrastructure is already there. Now my goal is just to take this fund and endow it, and then we know that our committee can do good work, and that these directly well, right? We just, you know, won't have to worry about it. Mary won't have to worry about keep on. You know, you don't want it to be like a hemorrhaging account. You want it to be a positive thing and just have it endowed.
And then we would still look, you know, to do things like the auction and things like that, but that would just be extra funds that would go into the endowment so it keeps growing.
Yeah, in perpetuity. So every $100,000 you put in just on a larger scale is $5,000. Yeah, so for every $10,000, you know, you get $500 put into it. I mean, it just perpetuates itself. So that was just my one idea. And until I get face a brick wall, we're not there at all yet. I think we can make this happen in the next 3-4 months. It'd be good for all of us.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
No hardballs or anything? Is it too great? I mean, really, this is just something. Okay. And
no,
again,
I think
it's not
a great idea.
Okay.
I think the key is meeting with Charlie and seeing how development feels about this, because they can be the wall potentially.
We'll work on it.
I don't think they will be, though. I think it would probably be a good thing with development.
Mary did a very polite introduction to me, emailing me with Charlie, and really endorsed it. So we just keep running with it.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, what dean or what person in their right mind would not have a good reason to fund this? You know what I mean? And like I said, if we get Alan on board, Alan would be in a position that if that could cast on one thing as an employee trustee is make this happen. He's got to do his part.
Right. And if we can get all of this lined up before our March meeting, it's a great opportunity to really
discuss
softly discuss it with them.
Thank you for your time.
All right. So next, just briefly, we finished the last of our on-campus open forums. We've got one more scheduled in Geneva on the 19th. No, that's fine. So we've got that one. But we're moving ahead. We've pulled together all of the data from comments and feedbacks from employees, and I'm compiling that all into little segments. That will go back to the main committee and then go out to each individual committee's their specific set of questions or comments to see if there's any tweaks that need to be made to the proposals. From what we heard, and Bridget, correct me or for anyone else who was there, the proposals were pretty on the mark. I mean, I think there are more questions about the culture change than anything. It's really, you know, the proposals are great and people would want to use them, take advantage of them, but getting the buy-in to do it is I think, the bigger obstacle. We still have some issues with folks who are on the research end of things, how that works, shift workers. You know, I think Geneva, Gemma, is going to be a whole other set of questions or concerns because a lot of the things don't really easily fit in Geneva. But I think we did well with them. Yeah,
I think we did very well, and I thought that even though some of the groups were
small,
not huge, we had some really great feedback. And we learned a lot, too, about the different pockets of the campus and how things are maybe a little bit different issues. So trying to bring them all together will be a difficult task, I believe.
But lots of good spirited discussion and, you know, at times people raising questions and other people in the group disagreeing, you know, so that was, I thought it was really eye-opening. That's good. The other thing,
one thing.
Yeah.
I would like to personally thank the two of you for all your time and effort that you guys have put in.
No problem.
It's been great.
It's been good stuff.
It's been great stuff.
We had our last leadership breakfast last Thursday with Q Wang. And he talked about essentially infrastructure buildings at the university. Several things he talked about was, you know, starting to look at the New York City Tech campus and the demolition on Roosevelt Island, how that building, the first building, is going to kind of start up and him working on plans for that. He talked a lot about scheduled maintenance at the university. So it was, you know, we had the budget downturn, a lot of scheduled maintenance stuff kind of got pushed to the side. And now we're getting into, and Jeannie, you work over there, so correct me if I'm misspeaking on anything. But a lot of stuff has kind of been pushed to the side saying we'll get to that. Well, now we're getting to a critical point where if we don't start addressing some of the scheduled maintenance issues, the university is going to start looking really shabby and not be appealing to students when they come to Cornell. And a lot of research out there shows that, you know, appeal of the campus is a big driving factor. So that's one big thing that they're really looking at. Other components of that.
Well, and moving to the new budget model and how folks are going to actually be dealing now with a lot of the deferred maintenance
themselves.
Mm-hmm.
Apparently, we found out with our new budget model is that we are kind of a leader in that area. So they're thinking about how, you know, they used to get their allocation from Central, and now they're going to be charging per square foot in the building. So, you know, if you're a department that owns a building, you're going to be dealing with the cost of that, and they're looking at different tiers. So if you're, you know, if you're the physical science building, your costs are probably going to be higher than, say, you know, a Goldwin Smith building, which is fairly low tech. So they'll be kind of tiering those things based on the buildings. But, you know, he was saying it will make an interesting situation in the past, you know, departments have looked to grow and take on more space, and now when you're having to pay for space, they expect to see that there'll be contraction. People won't want to own as much space. So there'll be less push for new buildings because you have to pay for them or
right.
the use of them.
Let me talk a little bit about the restructuring of the facilities department.
Yes, so three zones there are now. So there's several zones. So rather than there being
you know, folks who work in maintenance just kind of going wherever that you have a particular zone. So you'll become familiar with your zone. You'll have a zone point person. So if you're in zone A and you have an issue, you would contact your lead person there, and they would become familiar, so you would have kind of a working base of people rather than a person who may have never been in your building before coming in and doing work and then someone else coming in the next month to do similar work and having to start all over again. Bill?
Say how that's working out, because that's been in place for a while.
That's a good point. I was wanting to ask if there was any feedback from anybody, if they've noticed anything in particular that's caused a big issue, like now this is not being addressed.
The delay in getting the response.
Delay is not good?
Huge.
Yeah. In facilities, like open forums on the survey, we had a lot of talk about that because... and that came with just like this whole job satisfaction about the facility. So Maria Simaluka is relatively new. She started in June. And they actually have a task force that's been looking at the, once the zones went into place, that's been looking at things that were problematic with the zones. So they had certain things that they're trying to readdress through new systems of how they're doing it. So they didn't just say, all right, these are the zones, that's the way it's going to be, and everyone cross your fingers. They continually look for improvement processes. I know for the workers, there were a lot of issues about procuring materials would take too long. So they have a whole task force that's working on how they procure materials, because it used to be if you were in the electric shop, you could call up your supplier and order your lights. Now everything goes through central, so you have to send a note up to central procurement and they say, what is a T14? I have no idea what you're talking about, which makes a lag time. So with Maria on board and a real aggressive look at how the zones operate in some of those areas that are problematic, I think systematically it'll work itself out. Their initial evaluations were that the customers were generally more happy because they had the single point person to go to, but the employees who were implementing the work were less happy. And I think with Maria's pretty big shakeup of how the whole thing set up, it will flush itself out relatively quickly.
Mm-hmm. The work that gets done is great.
Right.
It's just a matter of time.
The processes.
Fill out a ticket, for example, in the few cold days in September that I noticed some air handling stuff in the box office that they all wasn't working correctly. I filled out a ticket and it was about a week and a half ago that they workspace that's been not above 50 degrees since
December. It's definitely been a challenge.
Definitely longer than it has been.
And
the positive side is that the people who are coming in to do the repairs are the same people.
Yeah.
So that, I don't want to see the negative.
Oh, no. It's the same feelings that the people who are doing the work. That's their frustration, because then that reflected on them. Well, people think I'm not attentive, and their own hands were tied. So a lot of the good thing is that a lot of that stuff's been identified as problems that need to be solved, and they're things that they're working on a regular basis.
Great. Thank you. Any other questions? Okay. Bob, you want to talk about budget? Did you have any updates that you wanted to get to that? Or?
Sorry, I didn't print out copies, but we gave our proposed budget to Ari last Friday. And all was said is none. The increase that we asked for over last year was only about $300 and change. That's reallocating the cost we used for the survey last fiscal year into the Kudos budget, the staff recognition budget. The administrative budget, which is our food to reflect the rising food costs and also additional members on the EA, and kind of combining all of the president's address buckets into one bigger bucket to see how much it actually really is, and increasing that accordingly for food costs and everything else. Everything else stays pretty much the same. We reduced the election budget. That was really the bigger area. We took money out of it just because it's something that has been utilized the last couple of years. And our requested budget for the fiscal year is a nice round of 10 grand as opposed to 97 and change last year.
Mm-hmm. Great.
And I'll send out a copy of that too. So just for your question.
Okay. Great. Thank you.
Thank you.
Craig, you want to talk about the UA?
Wasn't that the last UA meeting?
We can fill you up on that one. What did we talk about? So let's see. What did we talk about? Amy, what did we talk about at the UA?
There's reports from all the assemblies.
Oh yeah, there was assemblies reports. We talked about the situation that happened back in
November.
Yes, the whole plaza. Saying the report from the president was released, but the faculty are doing their own report on that.
About?
And
sorry, what are we talking about?
Which one was this?
This was the Israeli-Palestinian
groups.
And the fact that the UCB University property code and the campus code of conduct are slightly different depending on how you read and interpret. So one group essentially said, okay, they went through their proper channels to get a permit because they thought they had a group had to get a permit to protest on Hope Plaza. The other group read the campus code of conduct, did not feel that they needed to have that based on kind of their ability to have a free speech. And so when things got a little bit out of hand, campus police came in. Ari, correct me if I'm wrong. Campus police came in and there was question about who had the right to be there and blah, blah, blah. Did I get that right or wrong?
That's the rough outline of it.
Yeah.
I would defer to the report, which hopefully
I can see it now. Yeah.
OBA members too.
But there was a report done, and they're still working through that. The president had his report. The faculty are doing a report. There was a lot of question around whether the UA can, in our role as a governing body, should just move forward regardless of what other reports are out there working. At this time, I think we're waiting to read the report and then decide how to move on that. But I can send the report out to everyone. I've got the link to that. We also, one of the students talked about the notion of a double major or dual degree program, and the fact that the university isn't really encouraging of that. One of the faculty members talked about that shows a lot more stress, and there's no real benefit in the job market for having had multiple degrees. But we kind of told them that was really more of an essay issue. It was a short meeting.
Yes, it was a short meeting.
Mm-hmm.
If you don't mind me adding,
please do.
The infrastructure committee, which is a UA committee, will be meeting tomorrow afternoon with transportation. I heard a rumor that there's perhaps some increases coming in parking fees. So we're anxious to hear. Oh, not tomorrow. I'm sorry. Later on today. I'm glad and prepared for that.
Can I add to that if they're going to increase, that it would really be nice if they could properly maintain the parking lot so that staff don't fall?
Okay. Are there?
Because I have gotten out of the B lot or the O lot multiple times and fallen flat on my ass. Excuse my language. Because it's nothing but a sheet of ice because they don't take care of the parking lot.
Is there a drainage problem there?
No, they just don't plow them properly or put salt down or anything.
Actual injury.
In that same lot?
We're behind it, but same.
For the same area?
Yeah.
So maybe that's something
that's
that you want to address. So it's not under the transportation, it's probably grounds.
I don't know who it is.
It's still on falls in
facilities.
Yeah.
But I would imagine it would fall in infrastructure.
Yeah.
You can take the infrastructure. It'll get back to ground.
Yeah.
The ground.
One of the other items.
I don't mind if they increase the rates if they take care of the parking lot, so that. I mean, I prefer no increase, but.
Naturally, it's 3%, don't worry.
One of the other items that is on the agenda is talking about the safety of Tower Road up in the Cal's area, in the Ag area. I'm not too sure what issue has been raised, but that was something that was brought to my attention that they wanted to talk about. And then the third item we're going to be talking about was that at CUA, two meetings ago, there was a resolution that was brought up for consideration regarding affordable housing, not just for students, but for staff members as well. We had quite a lively discussion, as you may imagine, about what drives housing costs in the area and what the university may or may not be able to do regarding that issue. It's a very big issue.
That was talked at Fort University someday?
It was. Mm-hmm. It was a resolution that was brought up by a couple of the members, and it's been kicked back to the Infrastructure Committee, which I'm happy to try to address, but still feel like it's more of a campus planning type.
I was going to say, did they talk about Cornell Real Estate and the development of development of housing that's specifically for Cornell faculty and staff?
That was brought up, and you're referring to the
stuff over by the over like behind the horse barn near Judd Falls.
Mm-hmm.
There's a whole Cornell Real Estate is working with a local developer to do like townhouses that are available at affordable prices for faculty and staff.
For renting or purchasing?
For purchasing.
Okay.
For purchasing.
Because I've been here, I've been trying to pay so much attention to that. Like, what do they consider affordable housing?
Well, that's right.
I think it's pretty early in the process, but I'll look into it, and maybe we can have Tom Levine come out and talk.
Well, I just wonder, person in the S pay band cannot afford a house. Even if you're in a G band, you still might not be able to.
Try a D band.
I'd love to do that.
The only way you can get out here is if you get married. Like, really, you get time with two men. And I mean, I think that definitely, if people are, getting married later in life. I mean, relationships are changing. I mean, affordable housing here sucks.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, there's a lot of different definitions of how do you define affordable. Mm-hmm. I know that was one of the questions that came up in the UA. And is it just outside of the university, or is it also affordable housing here at the university?
Right. There was a lot of talk about grad students and what they're going to be facing for housing, as Maplewood will probably be taken offline. They decided not to put any more money into Maplewood. But the other component to the resolution was asking for more funds to be allocated to the off-campus housing office. So that's a small piece that I think that the infrastructure committee could probably take on and maybe make the suggestion that becomes a separate resolution, and then that can move forward while this other huge issue gets thought about and perhaps addressed. But that's what we're working on today with infrastructure. Thanks.
Yep.
Thank you.
So what time is it? So it's 1:24. So I've just got one other thing that I'll just throw out there because this has come up. I got an email from a staff member who was asking about the Kudos program, and her staff had worked on a fairly large project, and she wanted to nominate her staff of 20. So I'm a little bit concerned just because if all of a sudden we have a lot of staffs being nominated, if dining nominated staff or grounds nominated, it could be really large. So I just wanted to toss out the idea that I think, we've got Kudos here, which really to me seems like one or two, it's a small little subset of folks to nominate. Do we need to think about something that's larger and more team-oriented? Maybe it's not a Kudos luncheon, but maybe it's some sort of, team award, similar to like a George Peter Award where we have, teams can be nominated and we acknowledge them, but then we pick one who's the winner who gets a nice lunch delivered to them or something like that.
Like a project in the world.
Yeah.
Or can we defray the cost to her?
To what?
Like if she really feels like her team did a cool amount of work, can we defray the cost?
To the person who's making the...
Or to work a part of making the nomination.
Well, I think we should be encouraging them in general to do that. I mean,
right.
that's part of the whole new recognition model that we want. But I also think, you know, this may be an opportunity for us to just recognize people in another way, and just wanted to kind of...
I support the idea. I'm sorry, Bridget. I support the idea. I think it would be something good if we did something maybe similar to what we do for the George Peter.
That's a great idea.
Linda?
Could we maybe consider all the teams that we come forward for when we do the president's address and we want to do the recognition at that point?
That would be a good idea.
Choose the teams and recognize them at that point. Since we are always looking for who we could recognize and take at that point anyway.
Yeah, I think that's definitely a good idea. What I worry about is if we have someone who nominates like now and that's not until next October, does it get lost somewhere? So maybe we can tie the two pieces together to say, okay, you know, your team was nominated, so we want to provide you with a cake as thanks, and then at the president's address, we can acknowledge all of them and pick one as the winner to that. But at least we can give them some sort of immediate acknowledgement, and then have something like that.
I think that's a great idea.
But I'm just thinking, is this something that we can promote and start to think about? I asked Karen Rapponi about it because she's leading up the recognition stuff, and they hadn't thought about a team award, and they want to kind of get the things that they have up and running.
Yeah,
but this
right
may
now
be
we've
something.
Got a lot.
Yeah, but I mean, this might be something really simple to
yes.
you know to throw together and implement. And, you know.
But I feel like the kudos was meant to acknowledge one person.
Right.
The individual.
Right. Well,
right. Good job.
I agree.
Mm-hmm. Right. And that's why I think, you know, if we just say, okay, you know, there's this team of 20 and we buy a sheet cake or something like that and just, you know, go and acknowledge them. And
I think that's a really good idea. Otherwise, we could try to just get the whole campus to a outdoor picnic.
Which
and
yeah. Those are the Karen and I keep talking about ideas like that.
I guess I don't know how many people like submit, but also if there's you know, like there's special edition of the Paul Prince that's just dedicated to, you know, like something that's published.
So what we've actually just out of curiosity, how many people actually read the Paul Prince? Just really? Okay. So sort of sometimes. Okay. Because nobody's reading the paw print anymore, and it's a huge issue that we've been talking about
mm-hmm.
with Mary, that nobody's reading it anymore. Like 150 people are clicking on the links. So that's a huge problem because in once a month in paw print, we're listing every person who got a kudos and what they're getting a kudos for. So we're doing that. We're picking one person to highlight, and then everyone else we're acknowledging in the paw print. But nobody's reading it, so nobody's knowing that it's happening.
And some of the thoughts that we had about that was that the Chronicle comes out every week. I'm a little jealous. It
looks
nice.
Needs
a lot more polish than the Paul
mm-hmm.
print does. We don't want to necessarily see them combined. We still would like to have a separate publication. But how do we get people? Maybe we need to have a little something that if you go in and read it, you get entered in a drawing for a.
I think they're working on it, but Tommy said that he was willing to come and talk to the EA about communication streams and stuff like that. Greg, did you have something?
Yeah, it's off this topic, so it's just an idea. I was just curious how to explore it.
No, go ahead.
So I was looking at just benefits, and I'm sure this is a benefits committee,
yeah.
But educational benefits for spouses, and if there is anything available or any benefit to be had. And if there's not, if it's something we think is a good idea, the reason I ask is one of our managers in my area has a husband who's a full-time student now and came back. And I know there's the child tuition credit,
mm-hmm.
there's the employee benefit, but there's nothing for spouses. So I was wondering if that would be something that we could explore or where that would be explored or people would be even open to us exploring that.
So I think, and if I'm remembering way back when, I explored the education question with, and I'm going to forget his name, in benefits,
Paul
Bursick. Paul Bursick. And all of that is tied into the fringe rate, and what I was kind of told at that time is that to add more benefits, we need to take benefits away.
Well, what if it's the option where I'm not going to use the benefit, but I want to defer it to myself?
Yeah, I mean, I think that it's been a number of years ago. It was probably 4 years ago now, so it would not hurt to bring that question back up. And Lavanya is chair of education. Maybe you want to work with Greg and maybe send an email to Paul and just see if it's even been looked at.
I think at college, don't they?
Do they really?
Ithaca College also lets everybody go home at 3:30 on Fridays in the summer.
Really?
It's a college I'm learning does a lot of things.
And they have free parking. And
they have free parking.
They have free parking?
They have free
parking. But they also pay less than Cornell. So there's the trade off. You know.
Yeah, but what's the net gain? A lot.
Maybe.
A lot less? Yeah, they pay a lot.
Yeah.
What do you say? I keep thinking about moving back to Carolina. Cost of living.
Anything else? Because we are now 2 minutes over.
Motion for adjournment.
Second. Thank you.
This has been a production of Cornell University. On the web at cornell.edu.